Progressive Rugby League.
Hey, it has been a while, but the little engine that is the Progressive Rugby League podcast keeps on chugging. Or is it spluttering? Jono Duncan back on duty, and it's good to see you again. Rugby League is a game of personalities. You could say that about all big-time sports, of course, but there's something about the Rugby League personality. Now, generalisation incoming, but from this vantage, modern sporting personalities are pretty interchangeable across most codes. Close your eyes and take out the jargon specific to each, and you'd be hard-pressed to know if you're listening to a cricketer, an AFL rover, a golfer, a rugby union flanker, or a basketballing bounce pass specialist. And sure, modern rugby league personalities are probably also becoming more anodyne and corporatized, but even so, there's just something about them. I guess fundamentally it stems from rugby league's proximity to the rest of us, the people's game, all that. We all know rugby league has flaws, visible flaws, but hey, let's face it, so do you. And maybe it's a kind of familiarity that makes the rugby league personality just a shade more compelling. Or maybe it's just that I like rugby league. Either way, within the subset of rugby league personalities, I would say that there are only a few that, through doggedness, longevity, achievement, aura, develop their own kind of gravitational pull. There's an orbit around these personalities, an ecosystem that grows around them. Think Phil Gould, think Mal Meninga, think Wayne Bennett. Now, we all have some kind of Wayne Bennett baggage, don't we? And maybe that's natural for a figure that has coached the highest level across six, count them, decades. Maybe you're a Sydney sider who can't stand that he had a virtual origin side at his Bronco disposal to spank your suburban rabble once or twice a year in the 90s. Or maybe you're a Knights fan who blames him for your most forlorn period. Or maybe you're a Brit who's embittered at his role at the demise of the Lions concept. Or maybe you're a Queenslander who has ridden some barely believable success, but has learned over the years that ultimately, no one is bulletproof. Andrew Webster has written a splendid biography of Wayne Bennett that goes to the heart of what has driven him to be such a staple in all rugby league loving lives. But more than that, via his dissection of what is quite an extraordinary life, we learn more about, well, us. It's a great pleasure to be talking today about the wolf you feed, Wayne Bennett, the man, the myth, the mayhem, with possibly, probably, most likely Australia's most readable rugby league / sports writer, Andrew Webster. Thanks for taking the time to join the Progressive Rugby League podcast, Andrew. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for that amazing introduction. I'm glad to be here.
Excellent. It's great to have you along, Andrew. Now, before we get to the book, you are the first person I've spoken to that went to Vegas. I just got back from New Zealand today, so I was only following on from afar. I know you're probably tired of talking about it, but is there any additional insight since your trip about the whole experience, the whole long-term venture that has come to you with a little time and distance?
Well, I'm a big reader of Hunter S. Thompson, and there's a line from one of the biographies written of him after he died, where his first wife had asked him in a quiet moment, are you happy with how everything in life has turned out? And he said, well, of course not, but at least it was glamorous. And I think that's how I reflect on rugby league's first mission to Las Vegas. It was it probably wasn't everything that we thought it would be, but it was glamorous nonetheless. So yeah. I thought it was really good. I've got to say, when I had I went on the promo tour to Vegas in December and came back, the needle didn't move at all on ticket sales. I think they were around 18,000. And I was worried about how the game was going to pull it off. Mm. And in classic rugby league fashion, it all came together on the knot. And it was fantastic. Whether it's sustainable, whether it's going to get the rivers of gold of US wagering money or broadcast revenue or whether it's going to be just a money bonfire, I still don't know. We probably won't know for another 3 or 4 years. Yeah. But I've got to say, there was some, as a lifelong rugby league person, sitting there in that stand and watching those teams play in Allegiant Stadium, which is one of America's newest NFL cathedrals. Mm. I thought I was very proud to proud of the game.
Yes.
For a moment there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I was watching it in Wellington, New Zealand, and like I said, I was kind of keeping abreast of it from afar and reading all the articles leading up, and it seemed like, you know, all the journos were sort of really getting into it. I thought, it can't be that good. But then I saw it on TV and it looked the part. So, I mean, that's all you can really ask for. But anyway, that is maybe a chat for another day. We've got to get chatting about this very excellent book of yours. And I'd like to say congrats on the book. I really enjoyed it. But I must admit, Andrew, as I embarked upon reading it, I wondered if there was really that much more I could learn about Wayne Pennett. I mean, I enjoy your writing, so I was all in regardless. But, you know, there was that famous Australian story from years back. He'd published a few books about his life himself. So I thought it had the gist, you know, coaching doyen, devoted family man, all that sort of thing. What is it about Wayne's story that made you want to delve deeper, and what did you want to learn?
So the genesis of this book, I love writing books. This is the eighth book that I've written. The one previous was on the SCG.
Yeah.
But the one, well, that, the big sort of serious one, not the SCG book wasn't serious, but I mean the big chunky rugby league book that I last wrote was where I was the ghostwriter for Cameron Smith's book. And as much as I love that process and I loved telling Cameron's story, I didn't have complete control over the narrative of it. Mm. And I just swore that I'd never ghostwrite another book again. And I had a contract in place with the publisher that I did this Cameron Smith book with. And so I had to come up with another one. And it was late 2021 and Bennett was managing in that COVID-affected year to get South Sydney towards another grand final, another grand final for him. And I just thought, how does a then 72-year-old do this? How does he keep relevant to a bunch of younger players? As you said at the top, like over 60 years he's been doing this and he's still as relevant as ever and still as successful as ever. And I wanted to explore that. I've also been very obsessed. I've been a Bennett obsessive for most of my life. A coach obsessive for most of my career. I find them, coaches always fascinate me. The first book I wrote was about Jack Gibson, and he was a great mentor.
Yeah, right.
To one. But I was like you. I knew all the Bennett stories. I'd read all the books. I'd seen the Australian story repeatedly. But I wanted to write a book where I spoke to all these different people, not just his friends, but also his enemies and those he'd fallen out with, and just get to the real crux of who the real Wayne Bennett was. And that was sort of the mission from day one.
Beautiful. And we'll get to a lot of that through the chat. So convincing Wayne to engage and participate in this project was obviously a big win for you. Was he as open and candid as you'd hoped?
Surprisingly so. I write about it in the book, at the start of the book, where after I signed the contract, I know how rugby league talks.
Yeah.
So I called him straight away and left a message, and he called back about 10:30 that night. It was a Friday night. I'd had a couple of beers. I thought, probably not wise to do this, have this conversation now. So I'm an early riser. Got up about 5:30, 6 o'clock on the Saturday morning, and I texted him and said, look, sorry, I missed your call. Free to talk now. And he called straight away, and I explained to him that I'm writing a book about him, and he went really quiet. And then he said, well, if you're going to do it, I want it to be done properly. I want you to do it properly, and I'll give you whatever access to whoever you need, including myself. And ever since that conversation, it was a wicked dance between Bennett and I for the next 2 years. He would call me out of the blue at all manner of times and any different sort of day to say, I think you should put this in, I think you should put that in. I felt like he was manipulating me. Like he has so many other reporters over the years. But there was no question that I asked him that he didn't answer. I have to be very thankful of that, because he was so open. Like, there were times there where I'd be on the phone to him for 2 hours and he'd be in tears, and I'm not afraid to admit it, I was in tears. He talked about some really, really emotional parts of his life. I feel really quite privileged to get that access to him, and also to his family. I spoke to most of his family members, some of whom he's estranged from. I spoke to his partner, Dale Cage. He never got in the way of anyone talking to me, and for that I'm very thankful.
Yeah, it seemed to me that once he accepted that the book was happening, he started treating it like this may well be the definitive account of his life. I was surprised at how animated he seemed on long ago controversies or feuds and how keen he was to put the details of his side of the story forward. And there's one quote that really illustrated that to me. And it involves his early departure from the Raiders after the 87 grand final to join the Broncos, who were starting up in 88. He says, in hindsight, and I quote, "You look at all those clubs that started in the last 30 years, I'm the only one who's ever survived. I survived because I didn't let the bullshit get to me. I know what I gave up in Canberra to come home. I know, but I didn't blink. Here we were at the Broncos, struggling to meet everyone's expectations, and I walked out in a club that I knew was going to be a great club. I could have turned it up there. Oh, what a stupid decision you made, Wayne. But I never did that. I never regretted that decision. I never blinked." End quote. Now, to me, that's a man who wants to set something straight.
It is, but it also, to me, speaks to his own hubris. Mm-hmm. You know, I've got no doubt that Wayne went there because of the huge amount of money that was given to him by the Broncos. I found I was having to pick through the eyes of what he told me. Now, a lot of time was spent trying to get to the bottom of the truth.
Yeah.
And, yeah, that quote very much sums up. There's never been a more, how do I put this? It's actually it was an interesting dynamic. Like, I've never known someone to be so self-confident and assured of themselves, yet so insecure that they had to make sure that point was rammed home at every opportunity. He's got a massive chip on his shoulder, Wayne, as a kid from a broken home, from a small town in rural Queensland, and he's got a point to prove, and he still does, even when he was at the Dolphins in the year leading up to the Dolphins' first season. And he'd call me and go, "They're all writing me off still, aren't they? They're still saying I can't do it. They've been doing it my whole life. I'll prove them wrong again. That's what I do."
Yeah.
But that was extraordinary for a person who has won that many premierships and done everything there is to do in the game, and then some, to still be motivated to prove people wrong. And that, to me, it speaks to a confidence but also to an insecurity in who he is.
Yeah, very true. Now, I guess the other stuff that he didn't seem too keen on talking about was his time as a policeman. You know, you mentioned it in the book, actually, during the anti-apartheid protests in Brisbane in the early 70s. Was that just a plain and simple stonewall on that?
You're talking about the protests?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
I know, he was pretty... I thought he was actually quite... I think there's a quote in the book where he says he actually enjoyed the fact that he could lock up a few long-haired uni students.
Yes.
One of whom was most likely Peter Beattie, the Secretary of the State. I interviewed Peter for the book, and he was... You know, he gave an insight into what Queensland coppers were like in that period. Wayne certainly fitted that bill, but Wayne wanted to be like his uncle Eddie Brosnan, who was this legendary former Kangaroos player for a start, but also a legendary copper who didn't take a backward step. And Wayne always fashioned his life on Eddie Brosnan Senior, his uncle.
Yeah,
but Wayne found security and status in being a policeman, and I think we talk quite freely about him being a policeman, but it was never going to be enough for him.
Yeah.
For someone of Wayne's ambition.
Yep. Now, Andrew, I mentioned at the top, and you kind of referenced it throughout your answers so far, there's a bit of a gravitational pull around Wayne Bennett, where all this debris of people and attention and innuendo and well-wishes and nemeses seem to lock into his orbit, and they can't or don't want to get out of it. Did this Wayne Bennett ecosystem or economy, for want of a better term, make it easier or harder to convince other people to take part? Because there was a literal lifetime of potential interviewees you could have picked from.
I interviewed nearly 200 to 300 people for the book.
Yeah.
I was surprised at how many. There were some people that went and got his permission first. There were others, most notably like former Bronco CEOs, that were very reluctant to talk, either out of respect for Wayne or they just didn't want to talk about him. But there was rarely, I'm just trying to, to be honest, there wasn't many people who said no, either on or off the record. I spoke to quite a few people on the condition of anonymity, but mostly people went on the record, and I tried to get in front of them and sit down and interview them with the tape going as much as I could. So there was no there was no real stonewalling from anyone in terms of writing this book at all, which I think, I don't know, I've been around a long time now. I think I've got a strong rapport and reputation with most people in the game. If they don't like me, I like to think they respect me and that I'll do a decent enough job.
Yep.
And I think that was the case with this book. And to be honest, it made it, apart from making it absolutely bloody exhausting, because it was such a long process over 2 years, it was, I think it's having all those different voices made the book what it was.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Andrew, take us to Wayne Bennett's farm. You know, what's his address? What's the best road to get there? I jest, of course, but I do want you to take us to that dining table at his farmhouse as you're interviewing Wayne about his life, the highs, the lows, the middling moments, the controversies, glories, the family stuff. Who is sitting across from you? Is it an intimidating, overbearing presence? Is there a bit of the old Queensland cop about him? Is it a genial elderly man? Is he relaxed? Is he intense? Does he tap his feet? Is he a lip licker? Does he sigh a lot? Take us there, if you will.
So I got there. I turn up. Like, it was his idea to come to his farm.
Yeah.
Which I don't think I'm the first and only reporter to have gone there. And I turn up towards the property, and he comes down. He goes, "Come around the back and park near the hills hoists." And I did, and I got out, and he goes, "Take your shoes off." I went, "Okay." He said, "Make sure that fly screen's always closed. We get flies here." And I was like, "Shall do. Okay, no worries." And I was thinking, this is going to be fun. He said, "Do you want a tea? Do you want a tea or coffee?" I said, "Oh, I'll have just a black tea." He goes, "You'll have to make it. I don't know how to do it." So, Wayne, I'll show you. The thing I like about Wayne, he likes it if you give a little bit back. I said, "Wayne, I'll show you how to do it. You take that tea bag and you put it in that cup and you put some hot water in it. That easy." And then we sat down, and I've been in so many different Wayne Bennett press conferences over so many years of all the clubs he's coached. And that top lip, he curls that top lip, and his top lip was curled. And we sat down and went, "Righto, well, this is going to be a lot of fun." And then I turned on the tape recorder, and we had 4 hours straight. And I just, to the point where I just kept looking at my tape recorder to the little red light on it to see that the battery was still going. And he said, "Why do you keep looking at the tape recorder?" I said, "Because, Wayne, I'm waiting for the batteries to run out, because I don't think I've ever gone this long in one interview, in one session."
Yeah.
He was that candid and open, and he clammed up on a few things, but he... As I said, I was so... He's an intimidating guy. He still intimidates me.
Yeah.
He still scares me to a point. Like, you got to be on your game when you interview Wayne Bennett, or even when you're talking to him. He can be very, very tricky. And I get more nervous about not getting what I need from him, not what I need in terms of the story, what I need in terms of the book. But I think he was quite cathartic. It was a quite cathartic experience for him. A lot of it, not just that interview, but so much of what we had to, what the ground we covered. But there was only one time in that whole interview at his farm, and it was just him and I. His brother Bob was there, and he sort of showed up for a very brief period. But mostly it was Wayne and I sitting there in silence, apart from when we were talking. But there's only one period when he actually got emotional, and that's when I raised his wife, Trish.
Yeah.
He lowered his head, and there was tears in his eyes. So there's a lot of pain around their marriage breakdown.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, still at the dining table, Andrew, during these relatively intimate moments where you're pressing Wayne on significant points of his career and life, you know, like his marriage breakdown and his subsequent relationship, what character traits reveal themselves to you that help us explain what drives him?
Oh, that's a big question. I think he's big on trust. I think that's a big thing for him. I think it took some time for him to trust that I had the right intentions of writing this book. And my intention was to write a book about, you know, an absolute giant of the game. And I write it in the book. I honestly believe it. He is the game's greatest success story, because he came from absolutely nothing. As I said, there's a real self-confidence there that we all know, we all see, but I think there's an underlying insecurity of people forgetting his record and what he's done for the game, which I find remarkable. I would have thought someone like Wayne wouldn't care less what people think about him, but he genuinely does. I think he genuinely cares about how he's considered by the rest of the game. But he can also be a stubborn old bastard. Like he if there's something he doesn't want, he'll dig in and he'll give you the monosyllabic answers and the two word answers to what you wanted out of him. So yeah, he's a very complex character. Even talking about him makes me choke.
Yeah, I see what you mean, and I think that sort of level of pride that you kind of referenced there, that surprised me too, I think. And there was actually a hint early on after he won his first grand final at South Brisbane, where he was quoted as saying, "Winning a grand final means a great deal to me because I've had my share of knockers within the media and from people outside the media, and I've never been a loser, and it just annoys me that I had to win a premiership to prove I'm not a loser." That was my attempt at his voice. That is a revealing... Thank you. That is a revealing quote, because not only does it highlight someone who hurts when his pride is dented and someone who keeps receipts, but it also talks to his upbringing in a small Queensland country town. That part at the end, to prove I'm not a loser, it's almost like he's talking to the town he grew up in. And on that point, you kind of mentioned it briefly about his relationship with his uncle and everything. Can you briefly tell us about his childhood family life and how it explains the man that we've not really come to know? And then, of course, you know, the family he created with his wife, Trish, is also incredibly influential to this story. So can you tell us about the elements of the character we see and how they're explained by his familial experiences, both as a kid and as an adult?
His upbringing defined him as a man and defined him as a coach. Yep. I've got no doubt about that at all. And that's the thing that I explore quite a lot in the 130,000 words that I wrote on Wayne Bennett.
Yeah.
His father, Jim, was an alcoholic and a gambler, and a rogue is the word that his the Wayne's sister, Michelle, used to describe Jim Bennett. He put himself ahead of his family. And at the age of when Wayne was 12, Jim Bennett disappeared. The town of Warwick and the surrounding areas where the Bennetts grew up looked down their nose at the Bennett kids. They used to call them the Bennett kids.
Yeah.
They were hopeless, they were useless, they were nothing. And it really affected all of those children. And Michelle talks in the book about how much it really affected her confidence. But as for Wayne, it made Wayne very conscious about the man that he wanted to be. So he knew he didn't want to be Jim Bennett, mm-hmm. but it made him very conscious to look at how other men were that he really respected. And he took the best bits of them and put them into himself. And he basically created the person that he was. And that person wasn't a loser. So I think that drove him so hard to first get into the police force and then into coaching. And in terms of being a coach, I think he is giving just generations of young men the support and the love and the care and the guidance and the purpose that he was never given. And I think he still does that today. He still sees a young player that's struggling who comes from a broken home. He gravitates so much towards young players who don't have a father, whose father's left them, whose father's died. Mm. His fathers haven't been the greatest influence in their lives. He gravitates towards those players. Every player that I interviewed always said that. And Gordon Tallis gave me the quote of the book when he said, "I didn't fall under Wayne Bennett's spell because I had a good father." Yeah, I thought that was a really telling telling observation from Gordy. Mm. And that's the man that Wayne is. So when you talk about him needing to win a premiership to prove he's not a loser, I reckon there's a part of it of Wayne that he himself had to win a premiership. Mm. You know, it was another up yours to all those that had ever doubted him from the moment he was a kid all the way through his football career,
mm.
which I found fascinating. I found that such an interesting, it's not a redemption story, but just to see that someone could be driven so much by the shitty circumstances in which they found themselves as a kid. You know, mm. like he was basically the father figure in that family from the age of 12. And, you know, we explored that in Australian Story a lot, but I felt like we really got into the detail of it a hell of a lot more in our book.
Yeah, and I think there's a good quote also from his daughter, Beth Eichen, talks about how rugby league was his family. And she says, "You only grow out of that when you deal with your trauma, and I don't think he has. So that's quite an interesting perspective from his daughter, who I know they're not necessarily that close anymore, I believe, but still, I think it's quite an insightful quote from someone very close to him to kind of look at the man before her and see that what he experienced as a kid still affects him to this day and affected him as he became a father and had his own family with Trish.
And affected him as a father, that's the thing, though. I think that was a really important part. It was like he was being... And look, and Beth cried all the way through our interviews. That was one of the most confronting times in the book when I sat down with her for a couple of hours in a cafe in Brisbane, and we turned the tape on and off many, many times, and she was very, very emotional because it's raw. It's been tough for them to... You know, Wayne was the hero of that family, and he ended up having an affair with another woman and leaving. And it showed how fallible and human he was. But I think she made a really, it's a very, very raw point to say that, you know, my father never dealt with his childhood trauma. But by not doing so, it means that he's like, it's pushed him towards. His therapy is coaching young men, young footballers. That's how he's dealt with his childhood trauma.
Yes.
Not by talking about it.
Yeah, spot on. And it's interesting reading your book also, obviously, his experience as a father of two disabled kids as well, children who... That's kind of written all over his character as a coach as well. You realize upon reading your book and sort of learning a bit more about Wayne. So his son and daughter who were born with different disabilities, but that obviously placed a great strain on him and Trish, but they seem to sort of work through it, you know, incredibly well. And you thought they were sort of saintly figures. And then of course, the story about Wayne's infidelity arises and you realise he's a human being. So it all kind of meshes into a fascinating story.
It's very... Look, the hero of the book and the hero of his life is Trish because, as Beth explains in the book, without her looking after Justin, who was mentally disabled after having an allergic reaction to a vaccination in the 70s, and then Catherine, who was born with a really severe physical disability, without Trish, you know, keeping things kosher at home, then Wayne can't go and live his dream as he did. And Wayne knows that. Wayne acknowledges that. Wayne, no one needs to remind Wayne of that at all. Trish is just of the opinion, I think she said, I don't think the public can be reminded of it enough. In terms of his infidelity and his affair, I had no desire whatsoever to go and trawl through all the really salacious details of what happened there. To me, in terms of the book that I wrote, it was interesting to explore in terms of how the rugby league community and the broader public, particularly in Brisbane, reacted to it. There was no way, and I said this to Wayne when I was writing it, and I said it to Dale Cage, his partner, there's no way that I would ever judge them on, you know, on people on their relationship. That's completely theirs. That's theirs to deal with, and, you know, it wasn't a judgmental part of the book. For mine, though, it was the judgment that was cast upon them by everybody else, and particularly in a football sense at the Broncos, that they had never felt comfortable with the Broncos with the way that they were treated by management, by others in that club. And I thought that was something that needed to be explored. Wayne didn't want me to. He didn't want me to talk right about it. And I said, Wayne, I can't write about certain parts of your personal life. It's either none or all of it. And this is the important part of it. And it was front page news for days. So it needed to be explored. And I think I handled it, you know, in a fairly sensitive manner to all parties.
Yeah, agree. Now, let's get into more coaching analysis. Andrew, your wheelhouse here. Now, Wayne Bennett has coached rugby league, obviously, at the highest level across six decades, starting in the late 70s, and he's still going pretty damn strong in the mid-2020s. It's absolutely incredible longevity that would barely be matched anywhere in the world of sport, you know, anywhere on the planet. Was there an insight that you gleaned through this process that illuminated how someone could stay so relevant and vital in such a profession for so long, like understanding his great at, you know, the personal touch. But even so, like, how can someone remain so useful over such a long period of time?
There's a few things there, right? So the simplicity of his message, mm-hmm. like, he's just such a simple orator, and he just, his messaging to the team is so, he said, why would I confuse it? The young footballers who have certain tasks to do, why would I bamboozle them with too many intricate game plans and messaging before they're about to go out and play 80 minutes of exhausting football?
Mm.
That was one of the main takeaways. The other one was how he managed to relate, how a man in his early 70s can still relate to younger players.
Mm.
I find that remarkable. Like, and I mean, his ability to do that, there's not many. Paul Kent actually talked about this, about Wayne on NRL 360 the other night. That's a really good point. Like, even the best coaches, even Jack Gibson, even Tim Sheens, at some point it all passes them by.
Mm.
They become yesterday's man. But Wayne has never, ever been yesterday's man, even though he's coached more than anyone else. And I find that's, to be honest, that was the thing that made me want to write about it, about him in the first place. And I think the way that he does that is, one, he surrounds himself with good assistant coaches and knows how to delegate, but he also just knows the right question to ask players and how to become, just have that personal touch better than any other coach in history. Whether it's a question about the kid's family life, whether it's just, you know, sitting next to him at a game of cards and getting to know him.
And it seems like he doesn't mind having a laugh at it himself as well. He's got a decent sense of humour too.
Well, there's a great story of when he was at South and they got beaten 50-0 by Penrith, and he got into the gym early and they all came in there and he's pumped up Roy Orbison on the loudspeakers at the gym in Redfern, and he's pulled his pants up around his up to his armpits, and he's got a hat on backwards, and he's dancing around, and they're all laughing. And he said, "I don't know about you, but you know, let's forget about that shit on the weekend. Let's not do a video review. Let's completely forget that it happened." And then South went on an incredible run and made the grand final, and if not for an intercept and maybe for a Latrell Mitchell suspension, he wins his eighth premiership. So. Yeah. His ability to do that, and I know, like, people would look at that and think, oh, who gives a shit? But that's the art of coaching, to unlock young men, to be able to get them to get over the highs and lows of a football season and do things that they wouldn't normally do. So that's a part of it too. But the third one that I really got out of it, I always knew he was a master manipulator of the media. Mm. Holy hell, I did not know until I wrote this book just what that looked like and how hands-on and how devious he can be at using the media to his advantage. So there's a couple of great examples that I write about in the book. One of them, which was well known, was like when he was coaching Queensland in 2020 during that COVID year, and the Daily Telegraph wrote a column saying how this is the worst Queensland team in 40 years, and Paul Gallen backed it up, and Bennett was there and just rubbed his hands together and went, "Thank you, thank you, that helps." The other one was when... Well, the other two was when, in the early 2000s, when New South Wales had that record victory over Queensland in the third game. Remember when they did the try celebration with the hand grenade? And he had this annual lunch with a certain journalist from the Courier Mail.
Mm.
And he just walked in, sat down, wrote the score on a piece of, on a napkin, and pushed it across the table to the journos assembled and said, "That can't happen again."
Yeah.
I go, okay, well, what would you do? And then he wrote down the players that the unfashionable players who he thought should definitely be in that team. And they showed him the team, and they said, well, there's only one. Tony Durkin, and the Broncos media man at the time said, who was there, he said, well, the only problem with that team, Wayne, is that it needs you to coach it. And he said, well, that's right. And that was Wayne's way of saying to those journos that you're going to have to get Mark Murray sacked so I can come in and do the job. And that's exactly, within a matter of weeks, that's exactly what the Queensland Rugby League had done. The other one was the following year when he fired up Queensland journos to call Greg Dowling to pick the eyes out of the Queensland forward pack, and that's where the famous comment about Dane Carlaw from Greg Dowling was, "Looks like Tarzan plays like Jane."
Yeah, yeah.
Came out and scored the try that secured a draw, but also secured them the Origin Shield.
That's right.
Like, that's absolute genius. Dane Carlaw still doesn't know why Greg Dowling said it. It's because Wayne Bennett put him up to it.
Yeah, well, that's one of the fascinating things that revealed itself in the book to me. And that was because, like, I've always heard journalists say, oh, Wayne Bennett, he's playing his games again with the media. But, like, in my mind, I'm like, I don't know what that means. But he was really, like you say, hands-on and literally would sort of, like, get on the phone and background journalists and do what he had to do to get his way. So that was a fascinating insight.
Oh, he's an old gossip.
Yeah.
He'll ring up and chat about what's going on down there in Sydney. Like, I've had those conversations with him many times before. But he, at his very core, he is just an out-and-out rugby league obsessive. Yeah. He loves the game like we all do. And he genuinely wants the best for the game.
Yeah. Another hint I found from your book about Wayne's longevity is from Kelvin Giles, high-performance coach of the Broncos during his great run there. And he gives like a useful quote, I think, and Kelvin says, he's one of the greatest coaches I've ever met because he listens and he has patience. You're not surviving unless you change, and you're not changing unless you can listen. And another thing you notice about Wayne Bennett, and you notice it also about other highly successful coaches of the past 25 years, let's say Craig Bellamy, Trent Robinson, Ivan Cleary, is that they are far less likely than the average coach to use referees as scapegoats. Yes, they're sometimes used as pawns in a broader game, but rarely do you see them outright blaming referees for losses or going down a Ricky Stewart or Des Hasler-like rabbit hole of conspiracy or bitterness. You know, for all the mind games Wayne can employ in the media, it rarely involves a broadside at referees. And similarly, for all the blow-ups you see from Craig Bellamy on camera, he's always far more likely to blame his players' lack of effort for a loss than any contentious call. So I wonder if there's a broader insight or pattern there that of the best coaches treating their players carefully, but also as adults, which includes keeping them accountable for their performances.
He's got, everyone does it differently. There's different ways to skin a cat.
Yeah.
He's certainly a different character to Des and Ricky, both two coaches who I love and get on with enormously well, with having issues over the years, but they're also two very passionate rugby league men.
Of course.
But Wayne's got more of a control of his emotions than almost any coach I've ever seen.
Mm.
And he would never, ever... Yeah, that's right. He won't blame a referee. He just says we won't use poor officiating as an excuse to... for a team's performance, even if it's really the case.
Yeah, it's very rare.
But he's such a great manipulator that he'll use that poor refereeing performance to try and gain an advantage through the NRL, whether it's talking directly to the bosses of the game. He's always had a great relationship, whether it's Gallup or Volandis or Greenberg or whoever.
Yeah.
And all the way back to Arco and Quayle, he's always been smart in the way that he develops those relationships.
Mm. Yeah, I guess that control is important because when a coach whines about a referee, it's probably mostly a reflex action of self-preservation, and there might be a short-term benefit in terms of taking the pressure off themselves in the immediate aftermath of the game, but it probably has a negative longer-term impact on the team as it kind of gives players more excuses not to perform under pressure because there's like a persecution complex, you know, subtly bubbling away in the background there. So, yes. Well,
Don't worry. Bennett is the master of the throw-off, though.
Yeah, okay.
A lot of coaches will use criticising the referee straight after the game as a throw-off.
Yeah.
Bennett usually has a crack at the other side or their tactics. I've seen him do that many times before.
Yep.
He's the master of that one as well.
Yeah, that's right. This is why
I love him. This is why I find him so.
Yeah.
This is why I love writing the book. So I find all that stuff just so.
Yeah.
Fascinating, but also humorous.
Yeah, exactly.
He's so manipulative. He makes me laugh.
Now, Andrew, while we're on coaching, I was surprised at how much weight Wayne put on the halftime speech. He seems to think that it's a really important moment in helping determine the outcomes of games, and he seemed to love reminiscing about the impact of some of his best halftime speeches. So that was a surprising nugget for me, something I hadn't really heard from other coaches. And in fact, I remember hearing Gus Gould one day say that there's not really much a coach can do once that whistle blows for kickoff. Was there a nugget about Wayne's coaching methods that revealed itself to you that you found quite unique and made you think, huh, that's different?
That's quite good. I've been in the room when he's done a halftime speech. I did a fly on the wall piece when he was NRL All-Stars coach. I think it might have been the first or the second. It might have been the first year of the All-Stars concept on the Gold Coast. And I was in there at halftime, and then I was up in the coach's box with him at for the second half.
Oh, yeah.
And just because it's Wayne Bennett, he's got like this gravitas about him every time he speaks. There's a real aura about him when he's there. But I remember in that All-Stars game, he looked at the fours, he said, "They're sticking it up you, aren't they?" I remember Nathan Hindmarsh sort of sat there and looked at him, he said, "They're sticking it up you, Hindy." He went, and Nathan Hindmarsh went in and had the, you know, tore into the All-Stars team and they won the match. And yeah. I just thought, that simplicity in his message. There's a great story about Jack Gibson from the 82 grand final where he didn't even make an appearance, Jack, at halftime because they were going so well. I remember Peter Sterling said to me, he said, the fact that our coach didn't even make an appearance said to us how good we were going and just to keep doing what we were doing. And I thought, like, could you imagine a coach not appearing at halftime in a grand final?
I cannot.
But Wayne's similar. The great story is the 2010 grand final where St. George Illawarra, who are my team, so I love telling the story. They were down at halftime against the Roosters. They were all over the place. They were making mistakes every set. And I remember Jamie Sauer telling me for the book how he was expecting this big oratory from Wayne. And Wayne just walked in and said, "You're not playing like St. George. If you play like St. George, you'll win the grand final," and then walked out.
Yeah, nice.
Like, and that was enough for them to just default to what had got them to the grand final after 2 years of hard work under Wayne Bennett. And Sowie says in the book, they got a good set, received the ball from the kickoff, they got a good set away, and then Sowie got a great kick down into territory, found touch, and Sowie said, "From the moment that happened, I knew we were okay."
Yeah.
But again, that story in itself sums up Wayne Bennett, because the way Wayne Bennett tells that story is that Brian Smith, who was the coach of the Roosters, was in the other dressing room with the whiteboard out explaining with the X's and O's and explaining what they were going to do if they were to lose it. And
yeah.
I spoke to Brian and I spoke to several Roosters players who were in that dressing room that day, and they said there was nothing like that of the sort ever happened. So the Wayne story about how he got the Dragons going in the second half of that grand final, he still had to put a little kidney punch in to Brian Smith to further the Bennett legend, which I think to me is everything about him.
Yeah, yeah. It's one of his great nemeses and rivals, wasn't it, Brian Smith? Now, how should we rate Bennett as a coach? So his record is as formidable as you can get, but as, you know, as Brian Smith points out in the book, the premiership's dried up, you know, post his stint at the Broncos with that consistently stacked team. Now, you've done the heavy lifting on his career from the Brisbane comp to the Raiders, to the Broncos, the Dragons, the Knights, Broncos again, Rabbits, Dolphins, Queensland, Australia, New Zealand, England, Great Britain. I think that probably answers the question to some extent, but how should we rate Bennett? Do the numbers and longevity simply tell the story? Should we just stop there?
Well, in the modern era, like, no one's coached seven premierships, six at Brisbane, one at the Dragons. Pony Holloway back in the 30s, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, was it the 30s? But anyway, his record is better. Like, I suppose if you were going to make comparisons in terms of modern-day comparison, like, who would be his contemporary? Would it be Craig Bellamy, you'd have to say?
Yeah.
Trent Robinson's coached some pretty big teams to premierships.
Mm-hmm. And now Ivan.
But the coach of the century was Jack Gibson, who won five at two different clubs.
Yeah.
I don't know, I'm not a big ranker of players and coaches. I think they're all special and wonderful in their own way. I think Bennett, for mine though, when he won that premiership with the Dragons, that cemented it for mine. That was the big knock on Wayne, that he hadn't done it with someone other than those great Brisbane teams. And he also won those early premierships, and I explore this in the book too, in 92, 93. At a time when the salary cap wasn't as... it was in place, but it certainly wasn't policed like it is today. But I still, and I wrote this last year, I still think what he did with the Dolphins last year was his greatest achievement. Mm. I know they didn't make the eight, but remember, a lot of people were saying they were going to claim a wooden spoon.
Yeah,
I think that was among his greatest achievements, given the players that he had and the way that they played for him. So I put him on top. I really do. I'm probably biased because I've had my head buried in his life and career for the last 2 years. But Warren Ryan once said to me when I was talking about the greatest player of all time, I was writing about Andrew Johns, and he quoted a line from one of the three tenors and said, which one's the best out of the three tenors? And I think it might have been Pavarotti who said, we're not racehorses.
Yeah.
You can't rank 1, 2, 3. And I think that's a little bit like players and coaches. Like their records you can use to try and rank them, but I think the better way to rank Wayne Bennett, in my opinion, is without Wayne Bennett, what happens to the likes of Justin Hodges, or what happens to Neville Costigan, or what happens to Darius Boyd and Alex McKinnon and all these players that he's taken into his care?
Yeah.
And you can't buy that. But without Wayne Bennett, a lot of those players, they have really tough lives.
Yeah.
And I'm talking obviously with Alex after his injury, but Wayne Bennett has shaped and saved lives as much as any other coach in the history of the game, and I don't think that can ever be underestimated.
Yeah, no, really good point. And even his stint at the Knights, which I guess some people consider a failure, the Knights still reached a prelim, which is the best they've done in 25 years almost. So,
that's right.
Now, I think another thing, what's kind of interesting to me is, you know, he's coached some amazing teams, but I don't think any of them can be said to have revolutionized the game. It's a career based on fundamentals, you know, treating people like people and getting them to try hard, basically. And maybe that's the secret to longevity. Like a revolutionary probably burns out or goes out of fashion at some point, but the core, you know, core principles of humanity and effort are always relevant, as you kind of have alluded to. Now, Andrew, as someone who I assume makes most of his living being a sports columnist, where you can't dwell on a topic or issue too long because, you know, soon enough you'll have to smash out 1,000 words on something else. Is it refreshing to switch gears and write a book and focus on going deep on a single topic? You kind of alluded to it at the top about how much you love writing books. Is that the thing about writing books that you love?
Don't tell the Herald, but if I could just do that full-time, write books of that depth, particularly with the way modern journalism's gone, you know.
Yeah.
I've got a great brief at the Herald. I write whatever I want. But, you know, I think the whole industry, particularly sports journalism, is about hot takes.
Yeah.
You know, and tired of it. I really got into this book on Wayne because it was a chance to really stretch my legs and really explore something in depth. It took a lot of work. It's hard to do on top of a full-time job. But I just find this stuff is probably more, it's certainly more rewarding than the day-to-day grind of rugby league.
Yeah, like, it's one of those things, I get a lot of sports fans, and myself included, over the years, probably would have dreamt of doing a job like a sports columnist. But, and while I'm assuming it is a great job, but it would be exhausting too. Like every time people would be expecting you to have like a nuanced hot take about something, whereas you just sometimes probably just want to say, I don't know.
No, that's right. That's right. And it's when you've been, like, I've been, this is my 29th season of covering rugby league full time. So
yeah.
You see all the stories are the same. They're just different names and different clubs. So
true.
But Wayne endures. Wayne's enduring character who does keep changing, although a lot of what he does is still the same now as what he did when he was coaching, say, Brothers in Queensland back in the early 80s. A lot of it's still the same thing, but he's had such a big career and such a big life, and I remember joking with him at one stage and said, "You never had an easy year. There was always drama every single year of his career, either on or off the field." So that's what made him so compelling as a biography.
Now, Andrew, I've got an eye on the time, so one more question from me. And as I mentioned, I think you're one of the best sports columnists in Australia, and to me the best the best columnists to me never leave you feeling like you've just read filler, and instead, you know, within their analysis of a particular issue, you know, they're illuminating a certain insight into, you know, us, into the human psyche, no matter how subtle. How do you approach your bread and butter, that is the sports column, without giving away the secret herbs and spices? Do you have some rules that you adhere to, or is it just like a vibes-based approach?
Oh, it's very much a vibes-based approach. You got to write about what's relevant. And I try to be balanced. I really do. If I feel strongly about something, I'll go hard. But I like to think I'm pretty balanced in the way that I go about things. I always, when I write, I don't shoot from the hip. Every column I write is based on about a dozen off-the-record conversations, sometimes on the record. But a lot of it, I'll go and talk to every party involved on both sides of a story. A great example is probably what's happening with the Spencer Leanu story at the moment. So I'll talk to every party involved and try and get a greater understanding of what's happened and what's going and what's at play. Mm. And then I'll make my own opinion. Yep. And then every story that I write, if it's a column, has opinion on it. And you don't have to agree with it. I take criticism not that well, which you would think a columnist would have a thicker skin, and I do. But I really take offence when people say that I'm running someone's agenda.
Mm.
And I don't do that. I've never done that. I really take exception to that. I take my job really seriously, and I know the power that platform yields. So I make sure I do a thorough job. I don't always get it right. I might make mistakes. I might get errors of fact. But it's not through trying to be malicious towards someone. Let's give it to that guy today. That's not the business of that. So I try to be as balanced and thorough as I can. And sometimes I hit the mark, sometimes I don't, but always know that it's coming from a good place.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, it's been brilliant to have you on, Andrew. It's a story you think you know, but the further you delve, the more fascinating it becomes. So it's been really pleasurable to chat to you about the wolf you feed, Wayne Bennett, the man, the myth, the mayhem, or as I've been referring to it, Webby on Benny. Andrew Webster, thanks so much for coming along to this here taping of the Progressive Rugby League podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Progressive Rugby League.
Andrew Webster, ladies and gents, I mean it when I say it, one of the very best. Okay, thanks as always, folks. Seemingly random episodes will continue to pop up throughout 2024, so stay tuned. I know as a podcast listener myself, when a pod goes out of a regular rhythm, it's hard to keep across. So maybe just hit that subscribe button if you want to stay abreast of our irregular beat. All right, let's call it, friends. Until next week, somewhere at a farmhouse dining table of an NRL coaching legend, Rugby League, call me, and see ya.